This is the Decentered Media podcast with me, Rob Watson. Conversations about foundational and decentralized media. For more information, visit decentered.co.uk or follow on social media at Decentered Media. Hello, it's Monday the 13th of April and I'm Rob Watson and this is a Decentered Media podcast, and you might have noticed a slight change in my ident, as we call it, that it's no longer talking about community media, but we're talking about foundational and decentralized media. I thought I'd better update it because I was still also mentioning Find Me on Twitter, and of course there's lots of other social media platforms out there, so now it's the statement of Find Me on Socials at Decentered Media. Anyway, today I'm really pleased to say I'm joined by Megan Lucero and Debs Grayson, both of whom support or work for the People's Newsroom, and I've done a lot of work around independent news, independent media. I'll get you to introduce yourselves. Who wants to go first? Thank you very much for coming on, by the way. It's nice to meet you both. Debs and I have done work before with Media Reform Coalition, but this is my first time meeting Megan, I think. Although I might be, there's always the chance that I'm mistaken and I have a terrible memory. So apologies if we've met before. Megan, let's you go first. Tell us a bit about yourself and what your interest is, and what do you bring to the People's Newsroom project, and what's that about?
All right, lovely to be on here, and great to chat. Yeah, I work with the People's Newsroom, which is over at Opus Independence. We're trying to build a storytelling collective of journalists, artists, different kinds of storytellers that want to contribute to a different regenerative future. So really thinking about people who want to transition out of extractive models of whether that is media or anything mattering into our society. And we're doing that by building a story commons. We're building on practices of commoning as a way to do that. So we'll get into that a bit more. But yeah, my background, I've been working in trying to shift power in media for a long time. I used to work as the data editor for the Times of London. I worked at the Bureau of Investigative Journalism and launched something called the Bureau Local there, which was a grassroots participatory investigative network. A lot of the work I do now is really about deeply rooted community media, building a different kind of future for journalism that's rooted in people, rooted in power shifting, and really like collective and participatory processes. So our future depends on all of us participating in it, and we need to kind of expand the lens, widen outside of journalism, and look at this wider civic and information ecosystem. So this is where I do a lot of work now with different kinds of organizations to do that.
Debs, what about you?
I'm Debs. I live in Sheffield in the UK. And so at the People's Newsroom, I actually came across through Megan and through Shirish, who founded it a few years ago when I was working for an organisation called the Media Reform Coalition, which is how we met previously, Rob. I've been working in this kind of space of media reform. How do you transform these systems for a long time? And I actually met Megan and Shirish at the same time as I met someone called James, who worked for Opus in Sheffield. And then People's Newsroom ended up becoming part of Opus, and I moved to Sheffield, and then I ended up working for People's Newsroom. So everything kind of converged in a nice way. And when I was at Media Reform Coalition, I was running a campaign called the BBC and Beyond. And we were trying to reimagine or host conversations for reimagining what we initially were calling public media, by which we meant public broadcasting, but also all of the kind of space of kind of civic, independent news and journalism that, like Megan says, has this kind of sense of a broader purpose of social good beyond just, you know, profit making. But as we were kind of running the campaign, we found that this word public, this term public media, didn't really mean very much to people. And if it did mean something to people, it meant the BBC. And we didn't think that was very helpful. And we actually shifted to talking about a media commons and drawing on this language and framing of the commons to say, well, what if the ways that all of these different institutions could relate to each other was in this much more kind of collective, democratic, participatory way? And what if, you know, the role of the BBC could transform from being, you know, the kind of institution it is now to really being a kind of enabler of all of this other activity that is going on? So yeah, having done that, then kind of starting with People's Newsroom, and again, we've been talking about this idea of the commons, and shifting to talking about story commons, which is much more about the kind of practices of sharing stories, creating stories, making sense of stories, and kind of imagining that journalism could shift from being this thing of, like, you know, the strappy, you know, guy who kind of goes and, like, finds the story and then, like, goes and, you know, sells it to a newspaper. And it's actually a very extractive model, because it wasn't their story, right? It was like other people already knew the story. They didn't actually discover it. It's actually a mode of retelling. And when you do it within the current systems that we have, it's privatizing something which actually already exists as a, you know, in an interpersonal sense, stories do just get shared back and forth. And the ways that we share those and how we figure out what is appropriate or the right way to share a story is something that's this, like, quite subtle human process that we all kind of instinctively understand. But as soon as you try and take that model of how we share stories interpersonally and then contrast it with the way that conventional journalism works, you get this, like, real friction. And what we're saying is, could the world of journalism kind of be transformed in a way that makes it much more like a big community gathering where everyone sits down for a meal and then shares, like, for example, Chiwe, who's someone who works with us on this in Sheffield, she was describing growing up in Zambia and how when she would go back to family that lived in rural areas, the eating of the meal and the sharing of the knowledge about, you know, what is growing well, or what do we need to do to the soil, or which family is going to grow this thing next, or, you know, how are the chickens doing, or whatever. Like, there's that collectivity of, like, pooling all your knowledge and your stories, and maybe you'll bring in stories from the past or something that you heard from your grandmother or something that you're kind of, yeah, it's a form of collective wisdom. And what if journalism was kind of trying to be more like that than trying to be like, you know, I'm going to win a Pulitzer Prize?
I really like that analogy. I think I just wrote down that hunter-gatherers versus cultivators. And that actually, that's a really nice, simple way of thinking of it, isn't it? You know, that the lone journalist going out hunting a story and bringing back a trophy or something like that, as opposed to the work of the village to, you know, to ensure that, you know, you have a cycle of crops. I'm going to throw something at you both, which is breaking news. I've never done breaking news in my life, but it came up on my social media feed, which is that the UK government is going to build a central YouTube content channel featuring influencers. This is from Sky News, featuring influencers and everyday people in a bid to better communicate its policies to the public. My quick reading of this is that there's some concern that the government is not getting its message out, which is always the sign of a failing political process, to the public, and that other forms of engagement through social media platforms are gaining precedence when the kind of day-to-day work of what government does is not. This is what I'm presuming is going to the present government department social media channels are only reaching 2% of the public. It's like one of those journalists those hunter-gatherer journalists putting a microphone in front of your face and saying, "What's your reaction to that?" But what's your reaction to something like this, that our government has to kind of use these things? Is it encouraging that it's thinking in this way, or is it something that is it missed the picture entirely? Is it, you know, based on what you're trying to establish through the People's Newsrooms, what's your kind of first thoughts or feelings about what this might offer?
I mean, I think one is it's clearly a much delayed realization of their, as you say, their inadequacy to connect with the public and to be trusted and to be seen. But what's interesting and fascinating to me is the hop, skip, and jump between a government releasing it straight into the kind of TikTok, YouTube world, right? Hopping over what we would have considered traditional forms of, like, partnering with the BBC or partnering with existing media models, right? They're going straight to social media platforms that they see that. So to me, just as a, I guess, a intellectual exercise. If you step back and you look at that, you're saying there's a very delayed, because this has been happening for a very long time, but a delayed acknowledgement of, wait, this is where people are getting their information. This is where they are centering their energy, their attention, as we say in the attention economy at the moment, right? Their attention is over here. The government is finally acknowledging that and seeing it. The problem within this, right, is should the government itself be kind of doing that when there are so many people that are within the space? They could be, as you say, partnering or thinking about media. And there are so many people who are building trusted, independent, community-centered media that bring this to kind of different people. So my first reaction to this is a delayed reaction to seeing where this is happening, an acknowledgement, right? Like, as I said at the beginning, like, I have an interest right now in a lot of the work and research I'm doing around the information ecosystem. If we really step back, and especially as journalists, we need to step back and say we are one piece inside of that ecosystem. I believe that we can play a very important role in that, but our role needs to change. Our role needs to look differently. And we need to acknowledge that people are accessing news and are trusting sometimes untrustworthy sources, but are trusting and are getting their information in other spaces. So I think this to me is an invitation to really look at the health of our information economy. How are we engaging with it? And I do think there are potentially better ways to be sharing stories within this, but I'll pass to Debs before we get more into it.
I mean, my immediate reaction is that I suspect the outcome of it will be extremely cringeworthy, partly because they're going to these models, which are very much about interaction and also about authenticity. That's what people value. But they want to continue to use it as a centralized system. They have a message and then they want to use these channels to broadcast that message. It's actually very old school. And then when you try and do that with influencers who, for example, have really built their brand on the fact that they're saying what they really think, but now they're actually parroting a message for the government, I just think they're going to find uptake very weak. Like, people are not going to do it because it will actually be very harmful to their brand. And it also just completely doesn't fit with the medium. Like, and I would say, is the problem really that people are not hearing or understanding what the government has to say? Or is the problem that the government is not listening to the people when they're saying, yeah, I know you're saying you've improved my life in these ways, but my actual experience of my life is that it's got more shit. So if you can't repair the kind of democratic deficit in that way, then all you're doing is just, like, you know, trying to shout at people some more.
There's always a sign. I've always long said that when any government, Conservative, Labour, Coalition, whichever government, shoots the messenger, I think it's a, and I you know, from many years of watching UK politics, is there always used to be periods where somebody says, you know, we're just not getting our message across. And I always take that as code for, you're a rubbish group of people who are running the government and you need to, you know, move out of the way and let somebody else who can do a better job. Stop blaming the messaging and the messenger. So that's my personal opinion and experience. So, but that in a way, this is the government. And the government could invest, if it chose to, in supporting independent, accountable, trusted, media system. And I've my analogy, and I've used it many, many times. Hopefully, it'll kind of spare us into a conversation. It's kind of at the moment what our situation. Imagine a 1980s style shopping precinct or mall, whatever you want to call it, and on the ground floor there's lots of people walking around with their tablets and phones, and it's everybody bumping into each other, nobody really paying much attention. And that's our social media landscape, and it's everybody just left to fend for themselves. And then on the top floor there's Amazon and there's Netflix and there's these globalized BBC, and there's an escalator that goes from the bottom right the way to the top, but there's no interconnection for the middle floors. And the middle floors are abandoned and run down, and we're not, and government isn't supporting those middle tiers. You know, that Biden's phrase, wasn't it, during the pandemic, you know, building back from the middle or wherever it is, you know, that's used a lot. We've chosen to not invest in local, small-scale, independent media in that middle ground. So tell us a bit about the People's Newsroom in terms of what you think it's trying to address in terms of that problem of that breakdown of communication or relationship of trust and the vacuum that's being created because of the focus on the industrial, large-scale, globalized, transnational platforms and then the individualized, personalized, privatized experiences on the other hand. What is it? What are we groping for in the middle?
Well, I think one thing I do want to say is I notice in this statement about this new platform is that they're talking about bringing, quote, everyday people and real voices rather than government ministers, right? And I do think like to not miss that in it, which is like that is at the heart of this, is people want real people to be participatory in their media, and they're getting it from real people, everyday people. Every single day we're all being informed by an entire ecosystem, and for a lot of people that's not coming from the government or traditional media. So again, to kind of talk about like I think they see that issue, but exactly to your point, they're jumping to a different way of responding to it. But coming back to what the People's Newsroom is trying to do is to say that, which is to say media needs to be truly participatory. We all participate and co-create this. One of the founding principles that we have been talking about as a collective is when we're learning from the commons that the process is the output, rather than thinking about a story being the output on the other side, a piece that comes out. Really the process, the co-creational process of how that thing is made is the journalism, is the story, is what's kind of happening within that. And as you say, sort of you have that like really extractive global media, but what we're missing are really trusted organizations and people in communities that are creating this kind, creating trusted media at a relational level, at a, like a human level, that are also addressing complexity. We're in a world in which we're talking about polarization and binary ways of looking at things, the clicking of headlines, all of that. But the truth is, for all of us, like life exists in the gray, messy middle, in the complexity of multiple things being true. And people know that, and they're looking at media that's not reflecting what that is. So another kind of key element to what we're practicing in the commons is acknowledging what was, what is, what could be, centering the process and all of this, collaborative being a huge central part of it, creativity being a key thing that drives how we change and how we change culture and how we change the world, and having a different kind of form of accountability and care that's centered in all of this, right? That isn't, again, following a model of extraction. So these are some of the principles that we practice as a collective of storytellers that are practicing this kind of journalism to build something different. And exactly as you say, the news is that throughout the UK, this is absolutely abundant. There are incredible organizations that aren't always considered newsrooms, right? These are community organizations that are deeply rooted in place, that actually deeply care about their communities and are trying to transform their life and their living conditions. And as part of that, they're telling stories differently. They're informing people differently. They're equipping people differently. There is this, and this is the infrastructure that needs to grow. So exactly to your point, this is the middle ground that is like truly, truly useful and has deep roots and has so much potential to really shift us to a different future.
Did you see the Debs? Did you see the Ofcom report, the media uses report that says that social media use is declining? I mean, it's gone from sort of like 66% to 48% of people posting original content because reels have been introduced, people are becoming more passive about it. So we can't take that what's thought of as participatory social media for granted, because it's being exploited by, I mean, I took Instagram off my phone because of, you know, after a couple of sessions of spending over an hour watching absolute nonsense, I realized this is bad for me. And I took it off my phone and I've not watched any reels since, because I've had to put that marker down. It's just invidious kind of slop, you know, as they call it. But you know, in that context, that actually, what is it we think that people, why invest in a newsroom model, a people's newsroom model, a creative, a commons model? What is it that people, you think, need rather than necessarily what people want?
Well, yeah, I mean, I can just speak a bit generally to commons and what we mean by that. And I mean, in very general terms, a commons is a collective resource that is sort of cared for and stewarded by the people that rely on that resource. So often people will think about a piece of land that is a commons. And the key thing with it is it's different from this being managed by the state or by the market as private property. Instead, what you have is a set of kind of collective agreements about how to use a space, and a set of practices that people, it's like a culture that develops around how you relate to that thing. And we call those practices commoning practices. And it's one of these funny things that, as I say, I've been kind of exploring using these terms in relation to media for quite a long time. And sometimes it feels very difficult to talk about. And I think that is because really a commons is all practice. And actually, when you start to like lay down the rules or talk about it in this like external way, it sort of flattens it. So a good example for illustrating that is language. So languages are natural commons. Like clearly, like nobody owns a language. There is a kind of, you know, there will be ways that the market is involved, like with intellectual property, or that the state is involved through like defamation laws. But the vast majority of the ways that we use language are not, those things are not relevant to how we speak. And of course, when you can learn a language through a set of formal rules, like it will have a grammar, and you can look at it as a set, you know, you can learn it that way. But if you really want to understand a language, you don't learn it through those rules. You learn it like a child learns. You learn by repeating, by participating, by seeing what works, by testing things out, by making mistakes. And the point at which with a language that you truly can, you know, you can make jokes, you can understand nuance, you can write poetry. At that point, you don't have any conscious awareness of the rules. It's something that's just kind of sunk into your body as a set of practices. And that is what's difficult with other kinds of commoning, is that we don't have very many opportunities to practice them. But we can, I think there is an important thing here about validating that these commons do still exist around us. For example, the way people might use a park. The majority of the ways that people interact in a park, there might be some bylaws, there might be some official rules, but actually a lot of it is people just kind of figuring out what feels okay, what doesn't feel okay, what pisses people off, what makes people happy. Or, for example, the commons of care. The vast majority of care is provided not by a private provider, not by the market, not by the state. It's provided by friends, family, communities. And the ways that people negotiate who is going to care for who, how are they going to care for them, what feels good, what doesn't. It's this much more kind of diffuse collective process, which is constantly ongoing, which is actually the basis of everything. Like it's the basis of life. But yet we are kind of told that if we didn't have the state and we didn't have private property, the world would collapse. Like we would not be able to live together. And I think that is, you know, one of the stories that one of the principles of this story commons, we've written this series of pieces, and one of them is about, you know, sort of validating commoning as a way of being. Like we bring these commons to life by telling stories about them, because there's been a centuries long process of people being convinced that this isn't how we can run society or how we can meet our basic needs. You know, Thomas Hobbes saying, if you don't have like a strong man sovereign, life is going to be nasty, brutish and short. That's a story. That's a story about who people are, how we relate to each other, what is possible between us. Well, the tragedy of the commons, this story that was completely made up by a guy in the 1950s who says, oh, I'm imagining a group of people who are sharing a piece of land and they've all got some sheep and they all overgraze it and then the land becomes a wasteland. So therefore, this is impossible. He literally pulled this out of his ass. He did not speak to a single person who was actually engaging in any of these collective practices. And if he had done, as, you know, much later, Eleanor Ostrom wins the Nobel Peace Prize for, or not the Nobel Peace Prize, the Nobel Prize for economics, actually looking at how commons operate in the real world, and actually being like, oh yeah, it's actually a very functional way of sharing things. It's a sustainable way of sharing things. It is a much more sustainable way of using resources and maintaining resources than private property or the state. And guess what? It's also how humans met their basic needs throughout almost the entirety of history. So yeah, there's something important about saying, like, reclaiming that as a way that we can live together. And that is where this links with this stuff about how do we build towards a regenerative future, one where we're not endlessly extracting, where we're not endlessly taking more than can be replaced or sustained. Well, partly what we need is these stories about the possibilities of commons, and yeah, that this is a viable way for us to live together.
One of the frustrating things about this kind of period that we're in is it's like the pull to centralization and the monolithic model of everything has to be centralized. Now, apologies for repeating something which I've said many times, is when the NHS was set up in the 1940s, it was based on one of the Beveridge reports. And at the time, you had to bring all the clever people who could identify what the social needs were and the healthcare needs, and then reallocate resources around the country to meet those needs given the resources, and that couldn't be done on a distributed basis, but we've kind of got the technology now where it doesn't have to be centralized. We can have decentralized networks of information exchange, and in many ways, actually, Beveridge's fifth report, which was about civic society, actually, his argument was that the NHS maybe shouldn't have been centralised. It could have been locally provided for. But we've kind of adopted this model of kind of industrial scale centralisation, which still dominates our thinking. And the argument that's put forward is competing on the world stage, competing against other large-scale providers. And in the meantime, we're not paying attention. This is my argument. We're not paying attention to what's in front of us and the communities and the places that we live in. There's always this kind of gap. And Megan, tell us about the experience working, you know, kind of setting up and, you know, talking with people who've set up the newsrooms and the, you know, kind of preparing and planning for them in terms of what's that like in a kind of practical sense about when you're saying to people, look, you know, my experience is when you say, why don't we create, rather than waiting for somebody to improve the media, this industrialized, globalized media for us through regulation or through competition or through whatever mechanism, why don't we set up our own platform? Why don't we publish our own local magazine or set up our own channel or start our own radio station? And often it's like, it's met with silence. It's like the tumbleweed, and people are. What inspires people in your experience to kind of want to take part in this?
Mm. Well, one thing to say is that we're not trying to franchise a model and get people to set things up. Where we started is we looked around the UK and we said, who is doing the work already? Who is already planting the seeds of this idea? Because people are already doing this, and we reached out to them, or we knew them already, but we sort of reached out to them and invited them in to say, we want to learn from what you're doing, and maybe you want to, like, what would happen if we all collectively learned? So the beginning of People's Newsroom was actually just an acknowledgement of who around the UK was doing this kind of work and put it together. And surprise for anybody in the room, a lot of these aren't actually newsrooms. So Hood Futures, which is like an incredible organization for Black imagination in Birmingham, was one of the people we brought in. And I like to bring them as an example, because as you say, they didn't start out to say, let's create a newsroom. They're people who started out to reimagine how to serve and build a different kind of future. And they're creating incredible art spaces and art expressions. They're doing great, just, you know, equitable work to try to connect their community differently. And storytelling became a part of that, right? Like, how do they tell the story of what they're doing? How do they inform each other? How do they connect each other? How are they communicating this vision that they wanted to bring? And that's, I think, the difference. And something I should say is, like, when I tried to work in the world of changing newsrooms, I'm like, I found it a lot more difficult to basically get a journalist to give a shit about people than it was to find people who give a shit about people and teach them anything that they want to know about information storytelling. And that's kind of where this starts from. We're not trying to convince someone to care about human beings and do their journalism differently. We're starting from a different place. Who gives deeply, like, who cares deeply about their community, who's rooted, who's doing the work to try to actually better people's lives and connect people. What can we learn from them about how journalism and storytelling can be part of that? That's the difference, and the difference of approach of what we're talking about here. There's lots of organizations out there. If you want to set up a new platform, a new newsroom, there are places out there to support you to do that. Where we're kind of starting from is a different place, which is, where is the abundance? Where are the roots of people that are already creating this? And maybe they're not doing it in the traditional name of journalism or the name of a newsroom, but they're actually modeling a way to connect people. And at the heart of that, like, getting to your question really, which is, like, they're not coming from, we need to create a newsroom. They're coming from a very different place, which is, how do we reduce the poverty level in this space? How do we connect? Like, they're coming from basic human needs, basic connection needs. And of course, the information and news gathering and news sharing and all of that is critical to it, but it doesn't start there. And as you say, because a lot of people don't, some people that are really nerdy about journalism, like, love to go in that, like, yes, let's create a newsroom. But I think the more inviting invitation is, like, how are you informed and connected in your neighborhood or in the spaces that you are and the things that you care about? People don't kind of jump to the mind of, like, let me create an information platform. They're actually just thinking about who in their community is, like, solving problems for them, like, helping connect them to something, like, bringing something to life, bringing joy into their space, feeding their neighbors. And then the information ecosystem that surrounds that community of care is what's transformed on the other side. So that's just a bit of, I guess, context of, like, where we come at this. And I also think it's an incredibly ripe learning space for anyone who cares about journalism or newsrooms to, like, to pull from that. We also have great newsrooms within our collective too, Greater Govanhill up in Glasgow being one of them, and many others, which you can find out. But I think, that's a bit more context.
It's interesting. There's a dynamic at the moment because between, if you like, legacy forms of media and digital forms of media. And often when I speak with people, it's like, kind of everything is focused. Well, is there an app for this? Can we use TikTok for this? Can we? And it's like, you know, I support a charity in Leicester, which publishes a news magazine for the Evington area. And it goes out to about 6,000 households. And, you know, it just about covers its basic costs, and we need to develop it and improve it and find a new editor for it. And it's a real challenge, but the value that people place on that as part of the identity building for that community, that place, is really, really, really high. So when people say, well, you know, just make it all digital, and you get this a lot from the corporate communications managers of the health services and the councils, and, you know, it's like, it's not fashionable to say that you're going to support a community radio station with a small scale transmitter or a local community newsletter, something like that. But so it doesn't do anybody's job prospects any good if you've led a digital campaign and you've worked across multimedia platforms. It's very sexy, kind of, as you say, hunter-gatherer style, ego-driven kind of, but it's not really about the provision that the people living in that place actually need. Mm-hmm. And there's a big difference between wants and needs, which would be useful for us to maybe think about. So we've got this tension between the new and the established, if you like. But at the same time, I'm highly critical of a lot of the established producers who there's a tendency for them to be locked in that model. So when you say a word like newsroom, and a lot of, I absolutely kind of, it rings a bell with me. It's like a huge chime of kind of when you're speaking to journalists and all they can think of is news and information. And the DCMS report announcement last week, was it, for the media, or what it called? It's the kind of media, the local news media support that the government's going to be putting in place for this, talks about it almost exclusively in terms of news and information as a kind of very transactional information-based model. And I've always tried to say, well, look, you know, unless you have popular programming that are of general human interest that people can care about or care for or can recognise as being something which is part of the care for their community that they can participate in. You can have as much news and information as you want, but it won't get to people. And it's kind of that we're circling around this nutty kind of problem in the middle, which then is too difficult for people to kind of get their head into. Deb, you're nodding. What does that resonate with you?
Yeah, so like Megan mentioned before, so we've written these six pieces about lessons from a Story Commons, which we developed collectively with this set of organisations that we brought together, like Greater Govan Hill, like Hood Futures, Civic Square in Birmingham, AM, which is a cultural platform in Wales, National Theatre Wales, and then Now Then Magazine and Opus in Sheffield. And one of those pieces was around, like, in a Story Commons, we tell stories of what was, what is, and what could be, which I sort of pulled the words together for off of all of our collective conversations. And I found it so difficult. It took me so long to write it. But it was trying to identify these problems with the way that conventional journalism works, which is like they're sort of stuck in this endless present tense. They, you know, even the you know, inverted pyramid structure of a classic news story, it's like Shirish has done work on this, like it's the wrong way round for how our brains tell stories. It starts with what happened most recently, and then further down it tells you what happened before, and it's actually very it literally makes it harder for you to figure out what has gone on. And at the same time, so there's this kind of disconnection from the past. There's, like you've been saying as well, a disconnection from place, a kind of constant sense that what is really going on or what really matters is what's happening in London, in Westminster, in, you know, when actually most people's lives, that stuff is like, it obviously impacts it, but a lot of it is really irrelevant. And then you have this lack of, like, it's like journalists literally think that it's against their, you know, with this idea of objectivity, it's actually like a bad thing to do to even imagine what the future could look like, to speculate about what the consequences of something could be. And, you know, even worse to say, I think it, you know, we think maybe it'd be better if we did this thing because that would create this better future. And if we do this other thing, it will create this bad future. Like, that is sort of going beyond the remit of how, you know, in a conventional journalistic sense, what a journalist's job is supposed to be. They're just supposed to talk about the facts. And the future isn't facts. The future is some kind of speculation, some kind of imagination. But again, this is very counterintuitive to how human brains work. Like, we are constantly pinning things to the past, imagining the future. And like, actually, when you go into the cultural space, you do storytelling in a cultural space, nobody thinks that you should just talk about the facts or you should talk about right now. Or, like, of course, nothing would make sense unless you could say where something had come from. And also making sense of people's actions in relation to the futures that they're trying to build for themselves and for others. So, yeah, I definitely... It's interesting because in the context of the BBC, there is an understanding that this institution contains, you know, news and journalism, and it also contains culture. And in fact, a lot of the things that are most controversial on the BBC is actually its cultural output. That's a lot of what certainly the right-wing press likes to get very cross about. Like, there is a deep understanding that the cultural stuff is impactful, and it makes a difference, and it shapes how people feel about themselves and their lives and the future and what happens next. So, yeah, it's, again, in this idea of a Story Commons, we're sort of trying to break down this idea that the role of a journalist is just to, like, extract, you know, precise facts about something, when that's actually not how any of us really function or understand the world.
There's a tendency to the word influencer doesn't have good press to mix the metaphors. And sometimes it can be the extremes, you know, if you look through the Daily Mail and you'll see the influencers, the Beckhams and all of that kind of nonsense, which is kind of just kind of quite annoying. I watch a guy, it comes up on my, I use YouTube a lot because it's a, you know, I watch a lot of international content. I can't remember the last time I watched anything on the BBC because it's lack of relevance. And there's a guy, Stephen Cheatley, who does a vlog in Blackpool called A Walk on the Wild Side. And I've mentioned him before. And he just walks around Blackpool, and he's really fine. He's like, he's balanced. He's not antagonistic in any way. He just shows, I've learned more about Blackpool, which is one of those places which has a reputation, and you get the kind of drive by poverty porn tourism type news occasionally, which kind of sweeps in when there's a headline story, and then rushes out again. And you know, we saw that happen here in Leicester a few years ago, and you know, various lots of other places. And this is a guy who just walks around the streets of his town, and he's proud to be of his town, and he talks to lots of different people, and tells you what the weather's like, and tells you what's going on a Friday night. And you know, it's kind of, and he does it, and he gets he's making a living out of it, I hope. But there's a sense almost as that's the kind of, it's kind of. We're very skeptical of kind of the influencer model. Megan, what's the benefit from having a collective group to be part of, as opposed to just doing this on your own? There are good examples and bad examples, and we mainly see, if you look at the Daily Mail, you're mainly seeing the kind of bad examples. You know, what is it? All of the kind of celebrity and. Can't even remember the name of the genre of stuff, you know, the kind of the lifestyles, you know, life in Chelsea or whatever it is, all of that nonsense. I can't remember what they're called. But, you know, there's a whole frothy kind of fast food type, you know, industrial food. If you go into your supermarket, you can buy frozen pizzas, frozen meals, pop, soda, everything that's bad for you, and you can gorge yourself on that if you want to. The same with our media, but there's also fresh stuff available, which is potentially good for you if you cook it in the right way. You've got the skills to cook it yourself. What's the kind of the benefit of having that kind of collective approach as opposed to just leaving people to fend for themselves?
Well, you said that influencers get bad press. They get bad press from the press, right? Because the press see that threat. I don't think everyday people do. Like, they wouldn't, because their numbers are so large. You know what I mean? And so I think it's really important to think about, again, to come back to this wider ecosystem and acknowledge journalists would just take a moment, check your ego, step back, and truly look at what we're looking at. And the reality is that this is where people are getting information. This is how they're being informed, right? You know, your analogy of the grocery store, you know, the fast food and the fresh food, right? Well, fast food is up front and it's on the street and it's getting in from people's lives. Like, the equivalent of this fresh food is like in the back where no one can find it, in behind the corner where you have to run around and then you've got to, you know, pay an extortionate amount for it. So I think there's like an important thing to kind of look within this. I recently also published this, this framework called community news roles. And it takes a look at our information ecosystem, and it breaks down the different roles that everyday people play in this. And so there's the role of facilitators. There's the role of inquirers, documenters, sense makers, navigators. It breaks things out like this. And it just basically, some people can look at it as breaking up an act of journalism into different pieces. But what it does is that in each of these, we're highlighting how everyday people are playing these functional roles, right? So an oral history project is documenting a community in a way that a newsroom never would have, right? They have facilitators that are people that create dinner parties to talk about an election ahead of time, and they're helping facilitate community conversation in a constructive way, right? We have navigators like librarians who help people actually navigate a challenge in front of them. They're trying to come up with a housing issue and they can't, you know, fight their landlord on something, and they go to a librarian who helps them navigate existing resources to get through this, right? We have a wealth of people, and included in that are influencers and people on social media who are playing a kind of sense. In some cases, there's people that are actually sense making for people, actually speaking to something that's very live and real and happening in their lives and trying to help explain and sense make it, right? So I don't inherently have an issue with, you know, with influencers. And I think it's important for us to sort of say, let's step back and look at this whole ecosystem, look at how people are actually getting information. I think this is the real thing, is that a lot, in a lot of the kind of journalism world, we just want to like cover our eyes, or we just want to say the only real thing is that what exists on a newspaper, radio, or television or whatever, right? When the truth is that it sits inside this wider plant. I think there's an amazing opportunity for newsrooms to reimagine themselves as a kind of connector and facilitator of this kind of ecosystem. We don't have to find the story anymore. There are stories literally everywhere that people are trying to tell. What would it be to reimagine the role to say, let's create the infrastructure to elevate a series of stories? What would it be to bring our legal prowess to this, to protect a series of workers that are trying to tell a story? What would it mean to, you know, help create a different kind of platform or to connect people? Like, there's a totally different, especially in a moment of AI, right? Which, where people are accessing their information in different ways. Newsrooms can play that. And the other thing I think they can do is to say, look at all these roles that people are playing in our ecosystem and say, how can we help bring that level that we really pride ourselves in, a level of ethics and level of care, levels of rigor, right? Like, how can we partner with or work with people in our community to bring that? Because the truth is that we're already getting information from all these different sources. People are being informed by an influencer, and they're being informed by their librarian, and they're being informed by all these different things. But the reality is that, like Debs was saying earlier, the dominant private market is manipulating that ecosystem. And I think that's where our opportunity is, as newsrooms, is to say, we can come into the ecosystem and say, what if we brought in a level of values and care and rigor into it? What if we support, what if we worked with these existing ways that people are accessing it, and find a new role for ourselves, and to strengthen it, and to strengthen the way that people can trust different elements? Because as you alluded to earlier, people are starting to get very tired of a lot of this information. They're being overwhelmed by it. Their attention is being drained by it. And they are seeing, in some cases, that this isn't healthy or useful to them. This is the opportunity for newsrooms to kind of be able to step up into that and reimagine a different role.
I call this, well, I don't call this exclusively, but it's the foundational economy model, which is, I think we've kind of described incredibly well through this. It's the foundational media. And I'm increasingly hesitant to use the phrase, I've used the phrase community media a lot over the last 25 years or so. And I think it's becoming to lose a sense of specificity. It's becoming a bit vague, and you can get this community washing phenomenon, which is like, oh, well, we'll put that out to the community. Well, who are we talking about? We're actually talking about groups, specific groups and networks of people. So I'm a bit more drawn to being a bit more specific about the nature of what we call this. But the foundational model moves it on slightly, which is, we need to begin to start to, I think the case that you've just made, that you both made, is I think that's solid. How do we then move that into something which has structural support within civic society and within our wider public services expectations? So what's the argument about investment in media hubs, some kind of, I call it loosely, agnostic, that's the word I was searching for. I'm not antagonistic about which form of media. Some people are, I'm not. Which form of media is, it can be any form of media that reaches and communicates with people, that involves that participatory engagement and involvement of people creating and making their own media, telling their own stories, sharing their, having their own discussions, getting it wrong for themselves, getting it right for themselves. And so, but it needs some form of investment. Now, the case was made, 100 years ago for libraries. The case was made in the 1940s for health provision, education provision, schools, hospitals, the arts organisations. The people are pretty solid that to bring a community together, you need a theatre or a gallery or something like that. It's been under pressure for a few, for a couple of decades, but it's still regarded as something which is important and communities look forward to having them. What's the case that we need to make for supported hubs that enable us to not control and, I would rather the government spent its money on communications infrastructure, on putting in place media literacy style participatory hubs, rather than setting up a channel. Let people set up their own platforms and outputs, but invest in the skills, the infrastructure, so that you can, you know, the big challenge we've got here in Leicester is space for studios, working space, the public, you know, the co-working spaces that we've got close at something like 4:30 or 5 p.m., which is no good if you're trying to, you know, kind of edit podcasts, or if you can't work from home, you know, you've got limited options. And we're not thinking, what is it, the infrastructure that needs to be, you know, you can pay to go and sit in a cafe or something like that, but that can be quite expensive if you need to do 5 hours work and you're drinking a lot too much tea and coffee. You know, what's the kind of infrastructure that we need to put in place on that local communities, local places, local authorities, local civic society groups need to put in place? What would you ask for? Sorry, throwing a big question at you.
I think, I don't know if I can answer that completely directly. I mean, you kind of described something that I think would be massively useful. And I think, you know, having those spaces which can really link up, like I recently met someone from the Citizens Advice Bureau, and they were really interested in what we're doing, and actually being like the Citizens Advice are an incredible like early signal of anything going wrong. Like if a change in the benefit system is causing people pain, Citizens Advice will know it first. They're constantly receiving stories. And then what happens with those stories, and what could be the processes of kind of collectivizing those stories and telling them back to people so people can make sense of them? Or, you know, in Sheffield, I've also done some work on the Sheffield City Goals. And the stuff that I was doing was around creating some kind of metrics for tracking progress towards the goals over 10 years. And that being something that people can actually understand and engage with and feed into. And we've then from that been talking about setting up a data co-op in Sheffield, and again really seeing that as like, this is also a place for stories. Actually, you know, you're gathering data through all these different mechanisms, and is there a way of pooling the data that Shelter is getting, that Citizens Advice is getting, that the libraries are getting, that, and then you show it to people and you actually have that engagement of like, well, does this, how are you making sense of this? What does this tell you? And does this fit with what you know from your own life? So I'm always very interested in how you bring together lots of different types of knowledge in a way that doesn't mean that like the numbers or the things coming from the institution or the thing like that's the truth. And if your experience contradicts that, then you're just lying. But that does say the difference between them is not actually whether they're quantitative or qualitative or whatever. It's actually whether they're collective or not. The thing about quantitative measures is that what they're doing is they're pooling together lots of different people's experiences. And so then can you create these other kinds of spaces where people are coming together? For example, in a tenants union, people will be sharing stories about the struggles they're having around housing. And that might tell a similar story to what the data from Shelter or Citizens Advice is telling, or it might tell a different story. And actually, you need to find a way to, you know, in that friction, you might learn something really important about the way that an information system is working, the things that it's missing. And also the part of that thing of creating a collective space where people can learn to trust each other. You know, I remember talking to someone who was setting up London Renters Union and talking about like actually the importance of those meetings where people felt able for the first time to say that they had mold in their house, because it's a shameful thing to admit this. So or talking to someone from Independent Workers of Great Britain who was in the Couriers Union, and how actually bringing people together to acknowledge that they were having physical injuries, that they were struggling with like doing their orders in time, like that was actually a really big deal to create a space where people would even tell of the things that they're experiencing, because there was a very macho culture and a sense that like, you know, this is part of the good thing about being a courier is you're already a fast cyclist, but then actually you are in danger. And so there's something there about different kinds of stories that can be brought together, and also the real like subtle trauma-informed like sharing space. Like, what does it mean to actually share a space where someone would feel safe to share a story that is traumatic, a story that they feel ashamed of, and in the process of sharing it, collectivize it and be like, oh, it's not just me, it's actually these other people as well. And we can build our collective power through that rather than being isolated.
There's a kind of, I'm trying to, how to express this. There's a few years ago here in Leicester, we had BBC Five Live visit, and it's when we were involved in Leicester Community Radio, and they came for a day to talk about issues about the cost of living crisis, and they spoke to people during the day. But in the evening, they were over in Evington, and there was they were in a cafe, like a kebab Turkish cafe, and the presenters, I was listening in live, they spoke to the woman who runs the cafe for a few minutes, and then the presenters spent more time talking about their student days and what it was like to be living on kebabs when they were students. And it was like they spent, you know, 5 minutes talking about that, and they'd spent 2.5 minutes talking to the woman who run the cafe. And I was just appalled. And it was one of those things where I thought, there's no point in listening to this stuff anymore. It's gone beyond. They're talking about themselves. The decentralized approach potentially avoids, there's always a strength and there's always a weakness, and the weakness of this is that the kind of institutional model becomes turns in on itself and stops serving people. How do we ensure that the decentralized model, maybe this way, some thinking, you know, what kind of thinking do we need to put in place that kind of maintains that trust and accountability? So the civic society model is by its very nature a patchwork of lots of different types of activities in different styles for different motivations with different people with different agendas. And we wouldn't want it's as complicated and messy as that might feel. We wouldn't want everybody to be following the same viewpoint, the same agenda, the same, if you like, ideology, whichever, you know, it's an open, pluralistic, democratic process. How do we ensure that is doesn't get captured by the bureaucrats and administrators who want to centralize everything? And yeah, oh, well, you're funding, you've got to aim for these objectives. Yeah, you apply for Arts Council or lottery funding these days, and you've got to fill out an essay on social, so certain forms of social benefits, and it doesn't actually relate to the communities or the people that want to use that money for a good reason. How do we avoid a kind of a monoculture, and how do we keep that diversity of supply?
Well, I think a little bit to what you were alluding to earlier, like what does need to be centralized? There like coming back to the core of what that thing is, which is what is the things that need to be shared? What are the things that we have lost through extractive private market extraction, essentially, right? The idea that we each need to have all these separate platforms, that we each need to have all these separate resources, right? The idea of like a shared place that you were talking about, like a community space, public space, like, right? This is a centralized resource that makes sense for connection, but also is more efficient and more cost-effective for serving a collection of people, right? Like thinking about physical space that is shared, community space that is shared, is a centralized element. National and international safety, understanding, sense-making, right? These are where stories, instead of thinking about them from a top-down approach, thinking about them from a bottom-up approach, how many of us, right? Like the experience of a gig economy worker that Debs was talking about earlier, where like the experience of a gig economy worker is important to tell that in of itself, but there is also not a centralized, but a collective understanding of what are other workers experiencing that we need to centralize and fight for at a national or global level, if that company is global or national, what that might be. So coming back to me about, it's not about saying centralized is bad and decentralized is good. It's about understanding what is the function that they are trying to serve. And I think in this effort, centralizing public space, centralizing public resources for us to do that, models in participatory budgeting where we are collectively deciding that pools of money make sense, again, at a local level, largely, shared space resources, like that is literally what governments and nonprofits should be doing, is what would it look like to keep the lights on to pay the rent and keep the lights on for community organizations doing this work. And then the work that they do to raise money with them, whether that's from the community or others, goes into the programming, right? Like that would be transformative. I know several people who work, who've worked in community organizations around the country that have been lobbying and working with councils for years to try to say, what would it look like to transform a council building into a community space? How transformative that could be to look at big nonprofits or charities who largely get their money from rent extraction on high value properties that they own the land on and have loaned on for a very long time. They've talked to what would it look like to actually offload a physical property to a community space. So I think there are things about thinking, there are ways of saying what does need to be centralized for collective benefit, right? That where we are all benefiting, learning from things like the Library of Things, learning from the like historic library and also the actual library models, right? Like what is actually beneficial for us to centralize in that sense? And also to me, for stories, it's important, as I say, to not just think of ourselves, not to become so focused on the local that we lose our connection to each other, that we lose our connection and interconnection to other communities, other different elements, and also accountability that has to happen. As I was saying, like if you're a gig economy worker who's experiencing something, it's important that we also challenge that at the national and if that company is global, all the kind of way up, and telling those stories are really important. The problem is which direction of travel are we telling those stories, top down or bottom up? I'm very interested in participatory accountability that goes bottom up. And I think that's where journalism can be really effective. And that is a type of centralization. Jamie, so I think we have to just like debunk this idea of centralizing as being bad. But I think probably what we're really talking about is, unfortunately, a lot of what we experience that is centralized is not any of this collective centralization. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I just wanted to, I've been thinking at various points in this conversation about wanting to talk about accountability and regulation and, you know, some of the other work that I've done has been with Impress, which is the independent press regulator, and how they've been really pioneering like models of a model of regulation that is not based on a state body. They're not a statutory body. Instead, they've every couple of years they review their code for their members, and it's created collectively. And it's I think it's a really good example of a commons infrastructure where it's you know, lots of different publishers and media creators saying, okay, these are the standards that we want to be held to. And then the body can hold the responsibility of being the kind of arbiter of last resort. And so I think there's an interesting kind of layered accountability. So for example, with Greater Govan Hill, this newsroom in Glasgow that was part of our cohort developing these principles of story commoning. And they have a very kind of collective participatory process of developing. They have a bi-monthly magazine. And so you can see how accountability would happen, you know, in a very immediate day-to-day way. And I think that's what you want to embed at that level. But also you need to anticipate that sometimes there will be conflicts or differences which can't just be resolved at that level. So then having a code and saying like, this is what we've agreed to, and here's our process, like an arbitration process held by this outside body, that's our backstop. And what I think is one of the things that Impress is trying to explore is extending that to influencers and seeing if they can create a collectively created code for influencers who can then sign up and say, I'm regulated by Impress. Because what that does is it collectivizes the work of figuring out, you know, what is or is not good practice, what is or is not ethical. You know, I would say for influencers who are trying to do a good ethical job are, you know, it's really hard. Like they are really on their own. And they have often developed actually really quite sophisticated practices of responding to comments, responding to the ways their audience interact with them. But of course, sometimes people are malicious and people are kind of, you know, going after them with bad intentions. And then it can be very difficult to distinguish between like good faith complaints and things which are actually saying like you're not being held to your own standards versus malicious complaints. That's, you know, for a lot of these producers, they might be getting loads of views, but they're often doing all of their own recording, editing, whatever. It's too much really to expect them to also be their own regulator. So for me, that question, I think it links with this centralization, decentralization. I think it really makes sense to have a kind of backstop regulator, arbitrator that can provide a mechanism for complaints when they have to escalate. That can sit more collectively. And then within that, you can have this more distributed thing where influencers and producers are figuring out with their own audiences and their own stakeholders, you know, what makes sense for us as a group, knowing that there's this other place you can go if the thing is not resolvable on that more interpersonal level.
I've written down Anglo-Saxon versus Norman. And going, I'm not a historian, but there's James Horse's book about the shortest history of England is really good on this. He talks about the split in England, particularly in Great Britain is largely between the Normans and the Anglo-Saxons and the Celts. And it's kind of like occasionally the Celts and the Anglo-Saxons, the remaining Anglo-Saxons, get together and outvote the Normans. But he said, the split about North and South England is really illustrative. It's embedded. And it's this model. But the Anglo-Saxon model was distributed parishes. And the king was what you just described as the backstop of how complaints and disputes were resolved, whereas the Norman model was the centralized power of the monarch, and that was then enforced across the land usefully. So that if anybody's a historian would like to come and illustrate that in greater detail and discuss it, I'd be really, really happy to do that. But the other word that I wrote down as well was aggregation. So maybe one of the things about the shift in the technology is we don't need any more to centralize. We can aggregate information. So what we do is we go and look at what people are doing in that distributed pool of actors and groups and engagement. And then we say, okay, what information can we gather that? Yes, you've got to have a kind of commonality of the information forms, but actually we can make that interoperable a lot more easily these days as well. So we can compare apples with pears now. It's not quite the same as it used to be where we could only measure apples. So we're in a situation now where we can take that data, that information, and we can aggregate it and we can find out what's useful about it without having to centralize it. Centralization, for me personally, should be the last resort. At what point is it? Yes, there's a point where you recognise that there's an authority there that, for the good of all, you recognise the primacy of that authority. And I'm a big impress regulation and Ofcom regulation in terms of the broadcast code. It's not perfect, but it's a code that is commonly available. I'd like to see more democratic input into it, some more participatory input into it. However, I love the idea of bringing in influencers and other social media content producers. And the question I kind of, maybe we can kind of, before we wrap up with this, is what's the incentive for people to invest in their time, effort, energy, reputations to be those good players, to be those good actors, to produce good content, and bearing in mind who gets to decide what good is, again, is also a part of the open process of democratic accountability. So it's like, what's your kind of instincts for this in terms of your intuitions for what would be the best way to incentivize people to play a positive role?
Well, I think there's a perspective of coming at this from a service, right? Most media are not coming at it as a service. This is an extractive model, right? Like, this is a model that they're coming to profit off of your information and your use of their platform, right? You know what I mean? But I think people who really come at this with a value system, right? People who are deeply rooted in their community, maybe they're an independent media organization, maybe they're a community organization, right? They're deeply rooted in their community. Their idea is, we're here as a service. In the same way that people want to sign up to be a B Corp, or people want to be an organic provider, or whatever that is, right? There's this level, there's this threshold, there's a pride in wanting to do better and to do right and to serve a community in a specific way. And I think there's an incentive in that, in a world in which there is tons of information and tons of a provider, someone can say, I'm actually, we are regulated, not just that doesn't matter. That's our backstop. We regulate ourselves. We build a level of care and accountability in every action we do. And that regulation is only there as a final stop within. I think that is the other thing to think about with regulation is people often think of it as like this big shaming mechanism that happens on the other end of a dispute. But what when Debs is talking about that final stop, it's actually that every little step along the way, you're actually making sure that your community is represented and that you have a dialogue that's happening that isn't I, journalist over here, and you, community member over there, and you can just look at it on the other side. And then when that piece potentially scapegoats you or harms you or actually creates harm in your community because someone then ends up getting profiled or whatever the thing is, that harm is very, very hard to build trust back, right? But we're not talking about that kind of regulation. We're talking about a trust building exercise that comes with it. And there are people who want to opt into that. And like I said, I think that when it comes from a true service oriented, true community oriented, and you can take pride in saying, as they say in organizations that pride themselves in being B Corp, it's that level, it's that interest, I think, that we're looking
at. I'm going to throw one observation in on that, because I think it's a great point. But in a globalized media environment, it's often easier to find a community online, people who are interested in particular forms of entertainment, forms, whatever it is. And actually, you've got more chance of finding people in Southeast Asia or South America or, you know, kind of wherever than you have in your own local neighborhood. There's an anchor of place, which often with the, you know, how do we make sure that we have a prioritization for where we are, where we look, because we, you know, we're not all adopting VR virtual reality headsets and living in, you know, the metaverse. You know, that's not going to happen because I have to walk out of my house and go to the shops and buy some food or go to the laundrette or, you know, navigate the, you know, there's a place is still a predominant part of the equation. And sometimes I think we can idealize community, but actually, you know, people are building communities on social media platforms very successfully and very productively. But they're not connected to those people who live in the same neighborhood.
Yeah, I mean, I think we can overly fetishize place, particularly kind of neighborhood level, in the sense that, you know, Sheffield has, you know, maybe like 147 neighborhoods. And I also, for example, as a queer person, I feel in community with queer people in the city, and lots of them aren't going to live right next to me. But I do think that place is crucial. And like I was saying, with this thing of like the past, the present, the future in place, like how are we telling stories that link those things together and help us understand where we are? And I think that is really crucial because we have to see a relocalization of our economies if we're going to have any kind of like sustainable future at all. Like there has to be, and we know that these things are going to be forced on us if there isn't a more kind of consciously directed transition. Like we're going to see some massive disruption in our food systems, our global food supply systems. I would say almost certainly in the next 10 years, there'll be something where the government will have to re-engage with the fact that they actually need a food production plan for
our energy supply system is facing crisis exactly at this point.
Exactly. So these things are like actually foundational economy wise, that does have to be, and this isn't about being parochial. It's actually about really recognizing how interconnected we are, and therefore how extractive these systems are. I mean, for example, if we're thinking about the future of AI on a more localized system, it's like, well, actually, how are we thinking about where are literally our data centers are, our data, like what is our data sovereignty? How could our use of these technologies actually match up with the location where they're being used, which then would mean that these questions around, you know, water use or energy use or whatever, actually, again, it's kind of about what it is that our brains can make sense of. What our brains can make sense of is a bioregion. Like that is actually how they have evolved to understand complexity is a whole load of very, very complex things all happening in relation to each other in a place. And if our economies could transform so that they were more on that scale, then this like endless outsourcing of the problems that we're creating would like kind of, we would be forced to have to address them. I guess when you're talking about incentives, yeah, I mean, how we're going to move towards anything like that is very unclear, because what it requires is a huge disempowering of the kind of corporations and institutions and bodies that currently hold most of the power and that have zero interest in the kind of transition that we're talking about. But figuring out how you disempower those, and, you know, on a very basic level, there's an obvious way to pay for the kind of media infrastructure that we're talking about. It should come from big tech. That is obvious. But how do you make that happen? It's really difficult because these companies own half the world. I think that is the crux of the problem. Mm-hmm. And also, I think we can see, we can look ahead and see that events will overtake us. Like you say, I mean, what has just been happening in terms of disruption to the energy supply, what is going to happen in terms of disruption to food systems, these questions will become more and more live. And I think it is really important for us to be at least doing this groundwork of like, what does an information and sense making system look like that can help us shape this new kind of future that is just inevitably coming?
I do also want to, if I can say one more thing on place, which is, I think it's so important. Exactly. I agree everything with what Debs is saying about us rooting. But one thing I have seen in a lot of people that are about returning to the community, returning to small, is that to make sure we're also not being isolationist in our thinking about that, and that our sense of place is expansive, right? Because what our sense of place, a single place, isn't just, it is the ground beneath us and what's there, but it's also that the factory that is supplying this is also potentially part of deforestation happening, you know, on the other side of the world. It's also connected to corporations that are happening, doing extractive practices. People that are showing up, you know, in dinghies on our borders are connected completely to us. So I think it's like, we have to also, I've seen sometimes how some of this like hyperlocalization, which is super deeply important, needs to also acknowledge the permeability of space and of place, right? That we are affected by literally the rivers that run through Sheffield, as you say. You've talked about this a lot, Debs, are like influenced by what's upriver, what's downriver. Like everything is within that. So I do think we need to focus and deeply root in place, but also make sure that we are acknowledging the fluidity of migration, of our connection to each other, of neighboring towns and villages, but country and the world. And also, we live in a globalized economy, which is being, we are influencing people on the other side of the world with our decisions and practices, and are being influenced by others too. And I think finding a nice balance within that. And to me, like what I was saying earlier, my interest in the local to global storytelling is so incredibly powerful. You actually can feel potentially more equipped when you look at a story that you're like, oh God, this is happening. When you find out that, you know, maybe you're buying, you're consuming that at your local grocery store, and you can have it, you know, an influence in, you know, stories around boycotts or others. But I just wanted to bring that home as well, which is something I've learned from this space.
Well, we've not really talked about the whole storytelling process and the way in which stories are so important for social transformation. And that would be a whole episode of podcast in itself. I think this has been a wonderful conversation. I'm really looking forward to reading more about the work. I'll include links that you've both been undertaking. I'll include links in the description, and I'll put out a summary of the transcript summary of what we've been talking about. So if you want to keep in touch with me at Decentered Media, just go to decentered.co.uk and search for any blogs and podcasts that we do. I'm also available on all of the social media platforms, at most of them anyway, at Decentered Media. I don't do TikTok videos. But until next time, I want to say thanks to Debs and Megan. And it's been a really great conversation, and I'm looking forward to speaking to you again sometime soon. You've been listening to Decentered Media with me, Rob Watson. Find out more at decentered.co.uk or follow on social media at Decentered Media.